Welcome to HealthScope on WMKV and WLHS. Each week at this time, we bring you updates on a different medical topic and open the phone lines for you to join the discussion. Now, HealthScope on 89.3 WMKV, 89.9 WLHS, and online at WMKVFM.org.
We welcome you to HealthScope here on WMKV and WLHS. We are talking today about a very important topic. We're going to cross over into a little bit of GI discussion today, but really today we're talking about emergency departments and emergency rooms, something that many of us don't think about until that very moment that we need it. We pull a muscle, we break a leg, we have some kind of an inexplicable gastrointestinal issue. And that's when we run to the emergency department. We have Dr. Brandon Conine here with us. Dr. Conine is assistant professor of emergency medicine and the associate medical director of Westchester Hospital's emergency department. We'll give out some phone numbers that you can find out more about UC Health and Westchester Hospital in just a moment. But we're talking today about emergency care, and we'll cross over into a little bit of GI as well. First of all, Dr. Conine, thank you so much for being here with us.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be here. Appreciate it.
I always like to try to get to know our doctors a little bit more when they come in. What brought you to emergency medicine in this case?
Well, I'm kind of one of those rare people that have known what they wanted to do for a long time. I knew I wanted to be a doctor since I was 9. And at 16 years old, I had an awesome opportunity at my high school where we could do somewhat of a work share program, and I could get school credit for actually working. And I chose to work in a local emergency department. It was doing very basic stuff, just like stocking the shelves and helping out with patient care, transportation when I needed to, but really kind of developed a love and a passion for the emergency department, and carried that through all the way to medical school, and here I am today.
Well, that's an incredible opportunity because you actually got to experience both the stress and the rewards firsthand by being just in that environment.
Yeah, very much so. Like I said, I started out just kind of changing the bed sheets, and then one day when a patient came in a cardiac arrest, I got to perform CPR. And when you're a 16 or 17 year old student, getting to do something at that such pivotal and critical moment in a patient's care, it really has an impact on you, and that stuck with me.
One of the issues that I hope we can address today is kind of knowing when to go to an emergency room or an emergency department in this case, when to use maybe an urgent care, when to call your primary care physician, when to wait a little bit, and some things you can afford to wait on, some things you can't. But that's one of the things that I hope we can kind of tackle on this show. And quite often, when you think about emergency rooms, many of us think of a sports injury. We think of, a pulled muscle and a broken leg, a broken arm, something like that. But there are many different issues that can bring somebody into the emergency department. Is that correct?
Yeah, very much so. It's a very broad specialty. You have to know a little about everything to a certain extent, because you never know what's going to walk through the door, and whatever does, you're responsible for it.
And so you have to be ready for pretty much anything.
Very much so, yeah. From the chest pain patient to, as you said, somebody who injured themselves, such as a crash on 75, a motor vehicle collision patient, to really anything in between, from the young and the old, new babies or pregnant mothers, all the way to elderly care as well.
And we'll also, one of my other goals on this is to get people prepared. There's no way to prepare for when you have an emergency. Well, I guess you can to a certain extent. It's really good to have certain medical records or medical information that's available to grab as you're running out the door. Now, if you get hurt at a ball game or something like that, I'm not saying tuck it under your ball cap or something like that, but somewhere where somebody in your family can get that information and maybe get it to the emergency room or the emergency department pronto, so that in an emergency, you're not trying to remember every little minute piece of your medical history, or heaven forbid, if you would be unconscious, counting on somebody in your family or a friend to try to remember everything that's happened. So there's some really good documentations that we can have just in case.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. If you are a person that does have a significant medical history or medical problems, take a bunch of medications, or have significant life-threatening allergies, it is good to have that information on hand. Many patients that do have to go to the emergency department more often than others will actually have a list of their medical problems and a list of all of their medications and allergies, because as you mentioned, it can be difficult to keep up with at times. And if you are truly ill and truly sick, it can be difficult to relay that information to the doctors or nurses, and we are always very appreciative when you do present that information.
It also strikes me that as the physician in that emergency room, sometimes you have to make a snap decision on a medication. If you already know some of the other medications that patient may be on, it helps you make those determinations, because he or she may have taken one of those medications earlier in the day, and there might be, I guess, what they call contraindications or things that mm-hmm. maybe don't mix well.
Definitely. Contraindications, reactions, all sorts of things can happen, and that helps, because as you said, in the emergency department, we're making fairly quick decisions, sometimes with very limited information. And so the more information that's provided to us, the more that could certainly help.
We have Dr. Brandon Conine here with us from UC Emergency Medicine. He is the assistant professor of emergency medicine and associate medical director at Westchester Hospital's emergency department. By the way, if you ever want more information on UC Health, uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital, or you can find out more on any of the physicians at UC Health at 513-298-DOCS. That's 513-298-3627. Let's talk about maybe some of the non-traditional, I say non-traditional, you work in this environment, so to me it would seem like most of the people are coming in with, you know, strained ligaments, there's some kind of sports injury or something like that, or maybe some form of trauma from an accident or something like that. But are there some of the internal things that some people can have, like, let's say, the gastrointestinal tract? What are some of the common things that might bring somebody in with a GI issue into an emergency department?
Yeah, so for as you mentioned, a lot of people think it's all bumps and bruises and accidents, but the majority of care is actually other complaints, such as chest pain or abdominal pain. And when it comes to abdominal pain or a GI complaint, the more common things we see would be nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain just in general. And most of that is usually caused by a virus or other problems. But to me, being an emergency room physician, it's always kind of worst first. In other words, when I see a patient who's complaining of abdominal pain, in my mind, I have to rule out appendicitis, cholecystitis, or an infection of the gallbladder, pancreatitis, problem with the pancreas, a bowel obstruction, all these other things that could be going on and need urgent intervention, as opposed to other things which may be less concerning or less emergent, at least.
Right. So if somebody comes in and they're presenting just with abdominal tenderness or whatever, how do you, as a physician, what resources do you have at your capability to determine and start ruling some of these things out? I think that's a fascinating aspect that we, you know, if we go through the emergency room or the emergency department, we don't get to really think about, boy, what's the doctor thinking? We just want it to feel better now.
Sure.
But what are the things that you as an ER physician actually work with?
Well, a lot of it comes from just the very basic information I see. So when I look at our tracking board or our electronic medical record where we keep track of the patients in the emergency department, and I see that I have a 30-year-old male with abdominal pain, I'm immediately thinking of things like appendicitis, mm-hmm. the more common complaints in his or age group. Whereas if it were a 75-year-old patient coming in with abdominal pain, that shifts to kind of somewhat of a different, what we call differential diagnosis. In other words, list of possibilities that this patient could have. If it's a young female, I'm worried that she could be pregnant, have an mm-hmm. ectopic pregnancy or other complications like that. So it depends on the patient, the age, their medical comorbidities or other problems that they have. And then we look at their vital signs as well, because that could push you one direction or another.
Well, and that's what we're talking about. A lot of things we're heading into, as Deb Teitelbaum reminded us, we're heading into the flu season.
Yeah.
Here, as you and I are sitting here, we're recording this show, and we're live on the air on October the 6th of 2014. So cold and flu is like just
right around
impending.
The corner.
It's like a tidal wave coming toward us for many people. And so when you're dealing with cold and flu, there are so many gastrointestinal things, but also I've heard people complain about aches and pains and all kinds of things. Does the flu ever bring somebody into the emergency department?
Absolutely. We plan for cold and flu season. We plan for an uptake in patients. And some years, as you know, are worse than others. We look to the CDC and other governing bodies that actually can predict with a moderate amount of accuracy what the flu season should be like, and what type, the same way they go about making flu shots, which are always important and I do recommend, the same way they can predict what type of flu shot's going to be good for that season, we can predict worse seasons than others, and we go about changing our staffing for that. We go about preparing and educating our nurses and everybody to kind of be prepared. As you said, it is right around the corner.
Well, and I would think another big complication, and maybe somebody doesn't understand what's wrong with them, but do you see a lot of people maybe who have just gone through the flu? They said, man, I should be feeling better, and then maybe it's things like dehydration or other complications from other illnesses.
Yeah, we definitely see that. And with the flu, it very much is kind of a general illness in that it can cause headaches, sore throats, cough, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, fevers. Really everything can be involved. But it doesn't have to be everything. It can be a more individual thing. So sometimes it is somewhat difficult to diagnose, and it does take a little bit of extra work.
And we're talking here with Dr. Brandon Conine. We're talking about emergency department medicine, a little bit of gastrointestinal in there, but I have to throw out the questions that we were all talking about right before the program. One of the things that is really kind of sweeping, it seems like at least around our region, to a certain extent, is enterovirus, which is, I guess, an upper respiratory virus of some kind, and all the way to the extreme things such as Ebola. But first of all, how do you start dealing with somebody who may come in thinking that my child or someone in my family has enterovirus?
Well, enterovirus is a type of virus that can affect a person. And we have seen, and you may have seen in the news, an increased uptake in pediatric patients or children. Yes. That have been brought to the emergency department or hospitals with enterovirus. And for the vast majority of children, it may be something as simple as a runny nose, a sore throat, a cough, perhaps diarrhea or vomiting, but that usually passes without problems. But the difference between this latest round of enterovirus is that it has been caused a greater number of children to become ill and require hospitalization. So much so that our one of our kind of neighboring hospitals, Cincinnati Children's Hospital, was nearly full. And and did have to keep a very close eye on who was being admitted, and let other outside surrounding hospitals know about their current census because it was getting tight. Things are hopefully on the mend now and on the trend down, but remains to be seen.
From the standpoint of that, I think for a lot of parents, especially when it's your own kid, you're saying, "I got to go get help. I got to go get help." But at what point do you make that call to, let's say, a primary care physician, the pediatrician maybe in the case of our child, or do we just rush them the minute we might think they might have enterovirus or something that's not your typical common cold? At what point do we cross the threshold of just calling our pediatrician, or should we always call them first? What do we do?
Well, I think primary care providers provide an excellent resource to their patients. They know their patients well. They know their patients' medical problems and medications and their past history, which can all greatly impact their current complaints and current needs. So I think it is always a good idea to call your primary care provider because they may be able to see you that day right away, or they may say, this sounds a little bit more concerning and might need more urgent evaluation and to go to the ER. So using them as a resource is always appropriate. If there's ever a concern where your child or you become sick to where you don't think that you could wait, by all means, the emergency department is there, and that's our job. We're happy to help when we can.
And I guess it comes back to the old adage, better to be safe than sorry on
Absolutely.
Something like that. If you consider it a life-threatening or a severe enough illness or injury, definitely err to the side of caution.
Absolutely.
But I think there are also some people who tend to overreact, and I was one of those. One time when I pulled a muscle, I thought, oh man, I've ripped something, I've got to get to the emergency room. And that happens to some people.
Sure.
Sometimes at the moment of that initial illness or trauma, or you hit the 102 degrees or 103 degrees or something, you're thinking, uh-oh, This is major. I've got to go do something. And a lot of times people don't even think to call. Maybe it's after hours. They don't want to call the answering service for their primary care. And sometimes they'll just jump the gun and head on in. But again, better to be safe than sorry.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Now, when you were talking about youngsters, maybe with the enterovirus, many of them may be seen and then discharged, I'm sure. But some of them are kept. How does that process work? Because I think for many of us, we go into the emergency room, we expect to go into the emergency room, and we'll be discharged within an hour or two or a few hours. And I understand that UC Westchester, the emergency department, has a very good timing of things. You're
we
not
do
sitting
pride
there.
Ourselves on that.
Yeah,
yes.
You're not sitting there as you see in some movies and things where they do the stereotypical waiting room where they've been there for 24 hours or something. I mean, we're talking how long, Deb? 15 minutes. That's tremendous.
We're very proud of our door-to-doctor time averaging at or below 15 minutes.
Wow, that's tremendous.
There are certainly days that might fall outside of that, but that is certainly outside of the norm, and we do our best to have our patients brought back and evaluated as quick as possible.
So when a patient has to go from just emergency department care into actually going into the hospital for a longer-term observation or for other treatment, how does that process go? What determines that need?
Well, it very much depends on what brought the patient in. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about GI illnesses, more often than not, it's more of a dehydration problem. Are they dehydrated so much so that they their kidneys aren't functioning correctly and need to have IV hydration, or other GI processes such as appendicitis need to be admitted so that the surgeon can remove the appendix or the gallbladder for cholecystitis, for instance. So it really very much is dependent upon which disease process we're talking about. But after we've evaluated the patient, made our determinations, then we kind of can sit back and make the assessment if they need to be admitted or not.
We've seen it on all the TV shows. The patient's going, no, just send me home. I'll be okay. But you really do have to listen to your doc in this case, because you're meeting quite often that doctor for the very first time when you visit an emergency department.
Yeah, that is one of the challenges we have being emergency physicians, is that you're presenting to a hospital in what is likely a very critical moment in your life. Even if it is, just as you mentioned, a strain in your calf, it was scary, it was concerning. Mm-hmm. You were worried that you might have done some serious damage, and that brought you to the hospital. So from that to even a life-threatening or critical moment in somebody's life, we have a very limited window to establish that trust and that doctor-patient relationship so that we can make recommendations and so that the patient feels comfortable taking those.
We have a very special guest here with us on HealthScope today, Dr. Brandon Conine from UC Health and Westchester Hospital. He's in the emergency department there. If you would like to join the conversation today, our number here locally is 513-772-9658. Our toll-free number, 1-877-772-9658. Again, that's 513-772-9658 locally, or you can call us toll-free, 877-772-9658. I think for a lot of people, it's almost a badge of courage that they've never been to an emergency room, and they'll fight tooth and nail with their family to go there. But and many people, I think the deterrent is the fact that they've seen things on television and shows where people are complaining of being in this waiting room for hours on end. They don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, they say, well, heck, I'll be better by the time I get out, blah, 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 blah. But with a door to doctor time, as you were putting it, that's like 15 minutes. That's really a good average. Now, again, that's not a guarantee. It's not like the pizza place where they said, you know, delivery in whatever, one hour or whatever. But the bottom line is that you really strive to, I guess the word is triage. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Patients as they come in. And that's also a very important factor, I think, for patients to understand. Just as we talk about pharmacy, where everybody wants to spend a little extra time asking about their pills with the pharmacist if they have a question, the same kind of thing in an emergency room situation where it's not like people have scheduled appointments. You come in when you need it, and you want to be seen as soon as possible. But how does triage come into play here? I mean, that's really an important thing for people to understand.
Yeah, so triage is a process about evaluating patients and evaluating their needs that was established really through wartime with evaluating kind of mass casualties and large volume or large boluses of patients that coming in. And what we do is when you check into the emergency department, you're eventually seen by a nurse, given tell her your chief complaint or what brought you in there, be it belly pain or chest pain. Your vital signs are taken, and based on your medical history and that information, we kind of determine how much resources you're going to need in through your care, as well as how quickly you need to be evaluated. You can imagine in your specific instance when you came in with your calf pain or your muscle strain, as you put it, although it was very painful and we want to address those needs as quick as we can, that may have to wait for the patient who came in with chest pain and might be having a heart attack, or somebody that was in a motor vehicle crash and may be unconscious and need further resuscitation. So there is somewhat of a pecking order that's not directly as to what time I checked in, but the severity of your illness.
Exactly. And I think people need to develop some patience for that, pun intended, I guess, but to develop some patience for understanding that if you are there, as much as you want instant relief, and we all want instant relief when we're in pain or we have some form of distress, it is really important to understand that the goal is not for you to sit there for a long time. The goal is to fix people who are in the greatest need quickest and then work everybody else in.
Exactly, right, exactly. Right.
Now, we have open phone lines right now at 513-772-9658 or 877-772-9658. Carol has been waiting to talk with Dr. Brandon Conine. Carol, thank you for holding on. You're on HealthScope.
Yes. I have a problem with white coat syndrome.
Yeah, we were talking about that with blood pressure on a recent program,
yeah.
Yes.
So, my doctor died last February, and I have a new doctor and new health insurance. But when I go to her, my blood pressure goes up. I'm not used. I had a male doctor, and now I have a female doctor. It just bugs me.
Yeah.
Is there any... what do I do?
So there is a term, like you mentioned, kind of white coat syndrome, or in other words, you know, you may not have high blood pressure until you're actually sitting down in your chair. You get nervous, you get anxious.
No, you sit on the table and she talks to you on a computer.
Gotcha.
I know that can be
difficult sometimes. But a lot of studies have actually shown that people with the kind of white coat syndrome, or in other words, high blood pressure problems when they do go see a doctor, actually do end up having high blood pressure. And so it's something that certainly should be evaluated by your doctor.
Then she'll say, go home and take it in later on in the afternoon, and it goes back down.
Yeah. Well, that's good, you know, that you're taking a good account of your blood pressure, and that provides your doctor with more information. And in our field, it's always good to have more information than less so we can make those kind of important decisions.
Can I ask another question?
Sure, Carol, yes.
How about night sweats, hot sweats, hot flashes? I'm not a person that believes in pills. She does save me on cholesterol. I'm doing good with that. But other than that, what do you do with the... I don't want to go on no more pills.
Sure, I know. It can certainly be a burden if you're on a lot of different pills and medications. But if you are having symptoms such as night sweats or hot flashes like you mentioned, it is important to talk to your doctor about that, because there can be certain concerns that can cause that may need to be further evaluated. And it's not always pills, but it may involve some other testing to kind of see what the cause of it is.
Carol, we thank you so much for your call here today on HealthScope. Thank you so much. And actually, one tip, because I have white coat syndrome too. I found out at a very young age I had high blood pressure. And then for the longest time, every time I would go to have my blood pressure taken, it would be high. We'd sit and chat for a minute or two, and then it would go down. And what would happen is I started to warn either the nurse or whoever was taking the blood pressure. I said, I have white coat syndrome. And you know what? It's probably going to be high. The minute I started doing that and then take a nice deep breath and relax and not be nervous that it was going to be high, the minute I disabled that and told the nurse that, I was getting normal readings.
Yeah.
It was pretty amazing.
It still
controlled high blood pressure. I still am on medication for it. But they were worried that the medication wasn't working because the readings would still be high.
Right.
So, but frankly, to me, that was my safety valve that allowed me, I guess, to get over that. But it is distressing because you go in there and sometimes those readings are rather high. So,
yeah.
Carol, definitely talk to your physician about it. But tell him you have white coat syndrome before and see if that works, maybe. That's a non-medical recommendation. We have Dr. Brandon Conine here with us from UC Health and UCHealth.com and Westchester Hospital. And the phone number, if you want to find out more about UC Health, is at 298-DOCS. That's 513-298-DOCS or 3627. You're also welcome to join the conversation here on the radio program at 513-772-9658. That's 513-772-9658 or at 1-877-772-9658. Carol, thank you again for that call. We mentioned enterovirus before. And the fact that that has brought a lot of people to emergency rooms. What about the other E word, if you will? The big one in the news right now is Ebola. Now, we've not had really, I don't think, anything in the local area, anything involved with this. We're not
trying to incite
a panic. But what happens if somebody comes in, maybe they're running this fever, they suspect that they have something like Ebola. What happens in an emergency department?
Well, that's a good question. We, because of the recent outbreak in Western Africa and more recent news, the case that was discovered in Dallas, the CDC has made all sorts of recommendations for first responders such as EMS providers as well as emergency departments and hospitals on how to go about evaluating a patient, when to suspect Ebola, because as you mentioned, it's been very isolated right now in specific countries in Africa and the one case in Texas. But our UC Health in general and really all the local hospitals have developed policies on how to keep the actual patient safe, other patients in the emergency department safe or the hospital safe, as well as the providers taking care of those patients safe, because it is something that needs to be taken very seriously. And so we've had various bulletins go out with how a patient should be screened. And when we find a patient that might be concerning for an infectious disease such as Ebola, how to go about isolating them appropriately in order to protect really everybody.
And that's something good for people to know, that there is at least a protocol.
Absolutely.
We hope, and knock on wood, that we're not going to have it in our area, but we have people listening all over the country right now, and it's good to know that there are protocols involved for things like Ebola. I'm sure that there are for many other types of outbreaks.
Very much so.
Even some less serious diseases as well. Dr. Brandon Conine, our very special guest here on HealthScope. We're going to take a break here in the middle of the program. If you'd like to join us in the second half of the show with a question on emergency department health, we'll talk a little bit more about some of the GI tract as well. And I want to talk to him about full moons. All that coming up next here on WMKV and WLHS. Our phone numbers are open, 513-772-9658 or 1-877-772-9658. More HealthScope coming your way next.
The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program or of WMKV Radio, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS Radio, the Lakota Local School District, or its staff or management. Discussion of specific points and general topics on this program are not meant to be taken as specific professional advice.
And we're back on HealthScope here on 89.3 FM WMKV, also on 89.9 FM WLHS, serving the Butler County and also Warren County areas, as well as streaming around the world, WMKVFM.org. God bless you. And we are here talking about emergency department medicine with Dr. Brandon Conine. Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine and Associate Medical Director at Westchester Hospital's Emergency Department. We're learning a lot about emergency medicine. We've been asking a few questions on GI stuff because we are right around the corner from flu season as we're sitting here talking. And a lot of times that gastrointestinal mess that can happen can drive people into an emergency room. You know, and that's another question. I've heard some people, and I don't think I've ever in my life had what's called food poisoning. Mm-hmm. But some people will come into the emergency room because they have a either mild or a severe stomach ache, things like that. How do we know if we have something like food poisoning versus maybe we overindulged a little bit, maybe we just ate something that disagreed with us?
Yeah, well, the term food poisoning is actually characteristic of a very broad amount of GI or gastrointestinal problems that can come from actual an infectious process, so a bacteria or a virus itself that's infecting you, or potential toxins that those bacteria can produce. And it can cause fevers, abdominal cramping, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. And it can be shortly after eating food or even be an hour or days later.
So really, it could be as much as days later.
It can be in some instances.
And again, the best thing to do is prepare your food well. Don't eat undercooked things and whatnot. Is that generally what we would get food poisoning most likely from, either old food or things that were not properly prepared?
More often than not, the other kind of typical thing that can cause food poisoning is you're going to a family picnic. Somebody makes some delicious potato salad, something with mayonnaise in it, and it's been out for
an August day.
Yeah, it's been out for a little bit during the day, and you swing by for seconds, maybe after a little bit later, and that can develop and grow bacteria and stuff as well. So leaving food out can certainly be a culprit.
While we're on a few GI issues right now with Dr. Brandon Conine, one of the other things I still remember is as a kid, there was this commercial on where the person who was in the process of early on having a heart attack saying, oh, it's just indigestion, it's just indigestion. Are there times where people either misdiagnose or self-diagnose indigestion as a heart attack, or even worse, the other way around, where people don't go to the emergency room because they may be having some kind of a more severe issue, whether it's circulatory, digestive, whatever, and they say, oh, you know, it's just indigestion.
Absolutely. Dr. Google or WebMD is pretty good about getting general advice, but every once in a while, if that can be taken in the wrong context, and always is good to involve a professional or your doctor. But absolutely, I have certainly seen people that have waited perhaps too long, attributing their symptoms, such as chest pain or a heart attack that you mentioned, to a simple kind of indigestion or another problem going on, when in fact they were having a heart attack. So that certainly can be can happen.
And again, when in doubt, it's probably better to be safe. I know a lot of people want to avoid either the extra medical cost or things like that. But if you think this is something that's life threatening and maybe you don't have the time or haven't been able to reach your primary care physician and you worry about this, it's probably better to be safe than sorry. And I would imagine, and this isn't just about drumming up business for emergency departments.
Oh, yeah.
We're
have
talking
plenty of
here
business.
About, yes.
We want to take
care
of patients.
They don't need the business,
the
right? And frankly, they don't want it overcrowded. So the idea here isn't to create a stampede to the emergency department.
Absolutely
but
not.
It is about making sure that you can rule things out. If there is real significant concern that this is a life-threatening condition, I don't think anybody has ever laughed at somebody for coming into the emergency department.
No, not at all. We've had some funny things come in. I can't say that, but right. but we don't. We take chest pain, all these kind of things, very seriously, and specifically with timing, with chest pain and with stroke-like symptoms, we take that very seriously, and the timing is very important. If you have been having chest pain for a certain amount of time, it is better to be seen earlier rather than later, because the longer you wait, if you are in fact having a heart attack, your heart muscle is actually dying. And when it comes to a stroke, it's the same thing. Part of your brain is actually dying if you are having a stroke the longer you wait. And the treatment that we give for a stroke specifically is very much time dependent. So if you start having symptoms such as numbness or tingling or weakness on one side of your body, you notice a facial droop or changes in your speech or mentation, it's very important to present sooner rather than later.
You know, transportation to an emergency department is another issue that I would imagine most people, you're kind of in, you're caught between a rock and a hard place. Maybe you are having some tingling in your arm or something like that. Is, do most people end up coming in, I would imagine most people drive themselves or a family member drives them to the emergency room. But there are obviously times where we've been at emergency rooms or emergency departments when you see an ambulance pull up. Is there a point at which if you're alone, maybe you shouldn't drive yourself to an emergency department?
Definitely. If you're feeling lightheaded or dizzy, or you feel like you might pass out, if you're having substantial pain that you think is going to distract you from being able to drive safely, or in the case of a stroke, if you do have weakness to one side of your body or changes in your speech, it's probably best that you don't drive, and you should call EMS or your local ambulance services to pick you up, 911.
Exactly. Dr. Brandon Conine, our special guest today. We're talking about the emergency department, and he is an emergency department doctor. He is the assistant professor of emergency medicine, as well as associate medical director at Westchester Hospital's emergency department. And I have to ask, and I jokingly mentioned this before the program, and you started to nod your head. I've heard of full moons in emergency departments and emergency rooms. Is this a true phenomenon?
Yeah,
moon, full moons?
It can be. It's not just for werewolves anymore, I guess. No, full moons can, you know, it's been a long time, an old adage in emergency medicine that full moons kind of bring out all sorts of extra work for us a little bit. Whether it's just our perception or if it's real, there have been some studies that have looked at it and actually have seen a little bit of an uptick. And it may just be because when it's full moon, it's lighter outside at night and that more people are outside doing things perhaps that they shouldn't be. And so that can bring in a little extra business to the ER.
Wow.
There's also days of the week fluctuations where we change our staffing models in the emergency department because some days are busier than others.
And you mentioned Mondays.
Monday right now, we can usually expect a higher patient volume on Mondays as to compared to other days. And I don't exactly know the exact cause of it. Perhaps it's because if you are ill or feeling unwell, most people don't work Saturday and Sunday, and you're maybe willing to stay at home and try to kind of tough it out or suffer through it. But then Monday rolls around and it's time to go to work and you realize, you know, I actually am feeling pretty bad. I probably ought to get this checked out. I don't know the exact cause, but it certainly is a case, and we've got the numbers to prove it.
And from the standpoint of emergency department medicine here, you have to be very well versed not only in just about any kind of a health issue, but also everything from pediatrics to geriatrics. Is that true?
Very much so, yeah. As an emergency physician, I see anybody and everybody at any point in time. Some physicians do specialize in very specific focuses, but for me, it's kind of the world in general, a little bit of everything.
So that, and also I would imagine, and you kind of touched upon this in the first half of the show, it's a little different bedside manner than a primary care physician or even a physician, a specialist who may be an oncologist or a cardiac physician who visits people in the hospital but has gotten to know them. This bedside manner is something that has to be just instant almost.
Yeah, it does. And you know, I'd be lying to say that some people aren't approached different ways. You know, if you have an intoxicated patient who's being somewhat belligerent, I might approach that patient different than I would, you know, for instance, if you came in or something like that. So it's kind of about being flexible and kind of adapting to your surroundings.
And also, I've been in a couple of emergency rooms with other family members, and it really is I've never yet seen a physician come in and be kind of overbearing. It's generally like, hey, I'm getting to know you, but we need to get to the bottom of this fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. But there really is a challenge there of trying to be as firm as possible, yet be friendly and accommodating to people because they're
Absolutely.
In pain. I mean, the last thing they want to do is is chat, but sometimes you have to get really critical information.
Yeah, very much so. You know, this is another day at the office for me, but for the patient, that might be one of the worst days of their lives and one of the most challenging and stressful days of their lives. So it is certainly a delicate balance of addressing the patient's needs and also getting what I need in order to provide care for them.
This has to be one of the most rewarding jobs, but also in some ways maybe one of the most frustrating jobs.
It can be at times. It is very rewarding, and there are certainly times when I come home feeling fantastic because I was able to help somebody through a very stressful, difficult situation. And then there's other times where I didn't sit down the whole time. I didn't get to eat. I didn't get to go to the bathroom, and I'm bouncing from patient to patient. And it can be pretty tough and pretty challenging.
So let's compare this to real life to what we see on TV shows. As a younger person, I watched ER pretty religiously, and every week was one of the most stressful situations. There were always multiple stressful situations. It also seemed like there was always at least one show a year where there was only one doc in the whole emergency department. You know, people were out, all kinds of things going on. How frenetic really is it in an emergency department? I'm sure every day is different, but is it anything like what we see on television?
Yeah, as you say, every day is certainly different. Some days better or worse than others. But when you talk about being one patient or one physician in the emergency department, you know, sometimes overnight or on holidays, that might be the case. For me personally, one of my kind of similar episodes where I had something like that happen when I was the only emergency department physician in the ER at about 3 or 4 in the morning when there was a Greyhound bus accident just here on 75. It actually made national news, was on CNN,
yes.
And fairly highly publicized because a Greyhound bus crashed. And we got a phone call when I had, I think, 3 nurses and myself work in the emergency department that potentially up to 75 patients were going to be coming in all at once after a high-speed motor vehicle collision. And so it's about how you manage those resources and the resources that you have that you go about caring for that. And I'm proud to say that we handled it awesomely. We had our trauma surgeons come down. I had my hospitalists and other physicians brought in. We called in backup and extra doctors, and we took care of the highest amount of patients than anybody else in the region, and provided what I think was excellent care. So there are those challenges.
I was going to say that's tremendous, and I think it's comforting for people to know, even though in some of those wee hours of the morning when there might not be a ton of staff, there are staff and support staff on call that can be there, and surgeons that are there in a moment's notice.
We've got backup, and we've got backup to our backup.
There you go.
You better believe it.
Very good. And also, that's the other thing is, do you really get – your hearing must be very, very good, and your retention must be very good if it's anything like what we see on TV. When they're wheeling the patient in and the EMT personnel or EMS personnel are there rattling off everything that they've done, that is something that's really important.
Yeah, it is, and it's funny that you mentioned that because when I was an intern and just starting emergency medicine, I was amazed by my kind of more senior physicians that could walk into a room, walk out, not having written anything down, and remember, you know, 20 patients in a row and everything about them and all their labs too, and know everything about them, be able to dictate their note when I was struggling with one and having to take notes to it, and then eventually you kind of develop those skills and you can pick out the key words and key phrases and key information that you need, and it's kind of about weeding through to get that key information.
Just amazing. 513-772-9658 is our phone number, or 877-772-9658. Dr. Brandon Conine is with us. Wayne, thanks for holding on. You're on HealthScope.
Oh, hello. Hey, yeah, I've got COPD, and, you know, in case I go into like a rest, I'm a vet too, and I always go down to the VA downtown, mm-hmm. and if I'm like in respiratory arrest or something like that, or distress, should I be coming to a place like yours?
So you bring up a couple of interesting points. Anytime that you are in a situation where you feel like you can't breathe or you have chest pain or other emergent situations, it is always good to seek medical care, certainly with your past medical history. And sometimes the closest location can be the best. If you feel that you can't drive or you can't breathe, it's always best to call EMS, and they can assess the need. If you are stable, you know, you may be able to transport down to the VA where you've received your care in the past. But if you do require, you know, more emergent transportation or more emergent evaluation, our EMS colleagues are excellent at being able to kind of determine that and determine if you need closer hospital or closer care. If you are by yourself, you know, that's always somebody you can fall back on if you feel that you can't make that drive.
Well, the reason I was asking is because I live up here in the Mason area, and I'm less than 3 miles from the UC Center, the Westchester Medical Center. And, you know, the VA downtown is so far away.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, we are always here if you feel like you can't make it. If it's for regular appointments and your regular care, I'm sure that they'd like to have you down there. But if you feel that it's unsafe to go that far, then by all means, you know, if we're right next door, we're happy to see you.
That was what I was thinking about, yes.
Yeah.
That's why I was wondering.
Definitely.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Wayne, thank you for the call today.
All right.
Thank you. 772-9658 or 877-772-9658.
And one kind of follow-up to Wayne's question about seeking care at different hospitals. If you are a patient at one specific hospital or one specific facility that you've been seen at numerous times, if you feel that you can make it to that location, it is helpful because they do have your records. They have access to your physicians that you've seen before, and that can make those kind of critical decisions a little bit easier to make with extra information. We are lucky that a lot of times we can access other healthcare records, but it is always good to choose a doctor, choose a physician, choose a hospital that you like, you trust, and try to establish a relationship there to kind of have what we call continuity of care.
Yes, and that's so true. I know a lot of people will try to get to one particular hospital because that's where their primary care physician goes, but sometimes that's not always the case. And if you're in a severe enough situation, you may not even have that choice. That's, again, where you were saying the EMS teams and things like groups like that or people like that, professionals in those areas, will sometimes make the call. And quite often, do they communicate ahead of time with the emergency department to find out about availability or what kind of, you know, how stocked are you right now? Or do you have a backup of people or...
Yeah, so our EMS colleagues are excellent, especially in our area, about calling in and letting us know what they're bringing. So if you were to call an ambulance and they were transporting you for chest pain or perhaps you broke your leg, all the local agencies around here know to give us a heads up and a call just so that we have a bed available to you and ready and waiting and the staff waiting for you as well. So they're excellent about letting us know. And certainly any sort of critical emergency, somebody has a cardiac arrest or isn't breathing, they certainly let us know so that we can gather our resources to be prepared for you when you arrive.
And when in doubt, better be safe than sorry. You know, sometimes going to the closer location might be a good thing. As Dr. Conine said, though, if you are looking for that continuity of care and it's not a major issue, by all means, go to your regular hospital, by all means. Now, we talked at the beginning of the program about having some materials, some things on hand, maybe a list of medications, whether you have living wills, anything like that. Heaven forbid you would need it going to the emergency department. But what are some of the other paperwork and things like that that you would normally want to have if you were going to a doctor's visit or going for an admission into a hospital? I know most of us don't just have this laying around at home, but it's really not a bad idea to have some of this paperwork where at least some of your other family members would know. Is that correct?
Yeah, very much so. If you are a person who unfortunately does have multiple medical problems or medications or allergies like we previously mentioned, it is important to have that documentation. And a lot of people actually do carry that information in something like their wallet or their purse. Mm-hmm. There are small cards that most people's primary care doctors make available or hospitals make available where you can keep that all listed in a very small format. Everybody's got a cell phone nowadays. You can keep your information on your cell phone up to date because that can certainly help us out. If you're presenting to the emergency department with back pain and you have results of your MRI that you had last week, bring them. We'd like to see them. That'll help us out. It'll keep us from having to hunt it down and try to figure out what those were. So if you think it's pertinent and you have that information, by all means, the more information you have, the better.
And one of the things that I would imagine too is I know there are a lot of seniors. There was a big campaign to give them kind of a what looked like a sealed test tube or a little vial. And the idea was to put all your medical information in there and just put it in a corner of the refrigerator. So you would always know that I have something from the refrigerator. So That's one thing. But it's one thing to know it yourself. But it's another thing to let somebody else know so that if for some reason I would be in a serious enough situation that I'm unconscious,
right,
somebody knows where that information is, correct?
Right, exactly. Knows where the information is. And also, if you are somebody with significant medical problems or even just want a planner and like to plan ahead, having those discussions about your wishes, your wants, and how you want your health care to proceed if you are incapable to make those decisions is always important. In other words, establishing a power of attorney or advanced directives, things that you kind of alluded to a little bit earlier. The more people that know, the better for you as the patient and also for your family who may be left making those difficult decisions.
Exactly. We have Dr. Brandon Conine here with us, Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine, easy for me to say, Associate Medical Director at Westchester Hospital's Emergency Department. We have Pam from California on the line. Pam, thank you so much for holding on. You're on with Dr. Conine.
I hesitated calling because I know I've talked about our situation before, but you're talking, doctor, about symptoms. 6 days before we went to the emergency room, my sweetheart Dave all of a sudden said, I can't remember the last 15 minutes. And he had previously told me what he'd done. He'd talked to the neighbor, yada, yada. And I didn't like it, but I did know that he hated the thought of anything medical. And over the week, there were a couple of little incidents that he didn't tell me about. One he did, and I thought I heard a slur once, but then it went away. I guess my question is, I've always said, I hope that if anybody ever says, I can't remember the last whatever, and we have not been out partying, I've been there too, but I hope I have the nerve, but would I? If someone says, gee, I can't remember, and if I say, let's go to the emergency room, should I push this or should I? Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, he had what turned out to be dehydration a few months later, and this time we did go in, and he rallied after he got some water and some food in him. I'll cut the story shorter, but yes, so the second time I said, we're not doing this again, Pam, and it turned out to be we went to the doctor. We eventually went home and did go to the neurologist. They wanted to keep him for tests that night, and I said, no, I will be responsible. And then we went to the – because then he was fine, and then he was getting antsy and a little bit – I could tell he was himself. So when do you let go? When do you say, we better take care of this? These very subtle situations. How do you handle that as a patient or as a caregiver or as a friend or a loved one?
Yeah, and that's tough, kind of subtle things, especially if it waxes and wanes like you said with your husband there.
And by the way, I am totally blind, so I'm right. Not going to see. When I did call a cab, he said, I can't take him. I don't think he can stand up. His eyes are...
Mm-hmm.
You know, and things that I would not know.
And Dave was actually that other time was having a stroke, correct?
Yes, he was having a stroke. He all of a sudden he said, I can't feel my right side.
Yeah, yeah. Any time you have kind of the numbness, tingling, or weakness, or changes in your speech, if you do have a loss of consciousness or a kind of memory problems, that usually does warrant some further evaluation, unless you say, like you did before, they have some other obvious reason to explain it.
Yeah, well, because the memory thing, it was 6 days, and I had said to him, the night before the night it all came to a head, I said, if you're not feeling better tomorrow, we're going to go to the doctor. And then that was the night it hit.
Mm-hmm.
So, I've always felt a little bit responsible for the fact that I didn't drag him to the hospital.
Well, you know, it's tough, and a lot of people do kind of take responsibility and feel that way about them. But you do the best you can with the information you have, and you got to go on from there. But I know that can weigh heavy on our hearts sometimes.
Oh, it did. Well, thank you very much.
Very good. Well, Pam, thank you so much for the call today.
Thanks, George.
Thanks. We have Dr. Brandon Conine in the final moments here, and that's a kind of a poignant way to kind of wrap up part of our conversation is the fact that, you know, for families, number one, being observant and watching for warning signs, whether it's a potential stroke, a heart attack, something like that, but also being open and sometimes having to be a little more assertive and taking charge, because, again, it comes back to the safe rather than sorry type situation. You don't want to sit there, as Pam is doing, kind of beating herself up right now. Luckily, he was able to get help, and Dave is doing better now. But it's one of those things where you always will ask what if. So you don't want, if you don't want to ask what if, sometimes you have to be a little more assertive, I guess.
Very much so. You can't say safe and sorry enough.
Exactly. Dr. Brandon Conine, thank you so much for being here with us today, and we greatly appreciate your time and all that you're doing in emergency medicine.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Brandon Conine, Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine, the Associate Medical Director at Westchester Hospital Emergency Department. You can find out more about UC Health at UCHealth.com, /Westchester Hospital, in this particular case, especially for our WLHS listeners up there. 513-298-DOCS will get you information on any of the physicians at UC Health. That's 513-298-3627. We've been talking emergency department medicine today, and hopefully we all learned a little bit something. I know I did on today's program. Thanks to Dr. Brandon Conine. Thank you to Deb Teitelbaum. And thank you to UC Health and Westchester Hospital for today's Health Scope.
You've been listening to Health Scope on WMKV and WLHS, and streaming around the world at WMKVFM.org. Join us each week at this time for a discussion of the latest in medical technology issues and topics on 89.3 WMKV, 89.9 WLHS, and online at WMKVFM.org.